move to the fifth case this morning, or rather the fifth case this morning, United States v. Cook.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Walrath. I appear here for Anthony Cook, the appellant. The issue I want to highlight this morning is whether the district court erred when, as part of its calculation of Mr. Cook's sentence, when it applied a two-level enhancement based on a finding that the check cashing business, which was the subject of the robbery that Mr. Cook participated in, whether that check cashing business constituted, I'll put it in quotes for a minute, a financial institution within the meaning of the United States Sentencing Guideline 2B1.3B1, which applies to robbery offenses. I'll probably be referring to another guideline during my comments, also known as 2B1.1B16. In short, I'll refer to the robbery applicable guideline as 1.1. The other guideline is applicable to larceny offenses, and I'll refer to that as 1.3 for the sake of shortness. The district court found that 1.3 applied to the facts in Mr. Cook's case, and the difference that it made is this for the sentencing outcome. By applying that two-level enhancement, it moved his sentencing guideline range to level 24 instead of level 22. And given the calculations that then followed from the level 24 total offense level with his criminal history background, the court imposed a 60-month sentence. But if a
Isn't
level
it correct
22...
The counsel, was the sentence below guidelines?
Yes, it was. It was a below...
How far?
It was 17 months below the guidelines, the minimum for the guide. The minimum at a level 24 is, according to my chart, the minimum number of months would be 77. The range for a level 24 is 77 to 96. But he did receive a 60-month sentence on that robbery count.
And that was below also the range if the count, if it had been offense level 22?
No. Excuse me, yes, it would have been below that as well, yes. Because that, if calculating that, that's at 63 to 78. Yes, Your Honor. But my point is the court, and the court laid out, I don't have the page cite for me now to the record of the sentencing, but the court did take into account a number of background features about Mr. Cook and made reference to the fact of the nature of his participation in this offense. And that, it appears to me, led to the court feeling it was within its discretion to impose a below-guideline sentence. Which, in other words, I'm suggesting that the court had looked at it differently at level 22 rather than level 24. The outcome, instead of being at 60 months, would have been
below 60 months,
14 months lower.
Below 60 months for an armed robbery involving physical restraint with more than $300,000 taken. Is that right?
There was more than $300,000 in the robbery. Yes.
That would be an extraordinary sentence.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That would be an extraordinary sentence below,
well, the
below
court,
60.
The court was also aware that the defendant was being held accountable for the brandishing that occurred by another party to the offense. And I think that played a factor in the court's analysis as well. Now, I'd like to offer five reasons why guideline 1.3 does not apply in these circumstances. Basically, the court has before it kind of from what I can tell from the research that I've done, rather a unique issue. Because if the court looks at, and using Westlaw, for example, there are no cases in the Seventh Circuit that I'm aware of, at least from my Westlaw research, that shows any application of this guideline to a check cashing business. But in fact, I find no armed robbery cases in the Seventh Circuit that have involved check cashing businesses. But we're here to determine whether, in essence, whether this kind of retail establishment, a check cashing business, falls within that definition. 1.3, the first reason I'd like to advocate that this is an overly expansive application, my argument would go to in the general application principles of the guidelines themselves at 1B1, there's a statement as follows in the application notes. Definitions of terms also may appear in other sections. Such definitions are not designed for general applicability. Instead, applicability must be determined on a case-by-case basis. I offer that point because the government, maybe today and previously in the case, has argued, well, the way to inform what the 1.3 financial institution term means is to look at the larceny 1.3 guideline definition, where there is a very detailed, very long definition of what a financial institution is under the larceny guideline. There is no such comparable definition under substituted the wrong guideline numbers, but my point is that the robbery guideline 1.3 has no comparable lengthy definition as you find in 1.1, and the first principle in 1.B.1 of the commentary to the guidelines says you don't look at definitions in another guideline for general applicability.
How about just looking at the title of the outfit he robbed?
I beg your pardon.
What was the name of the organization he robbed?
The embarrassing fact in this case is that the name of the business was the Community Financial Services Center. Yes,
you know, we're involved in sentencing, and we're spending more time regarding sentencing that was probably firstly spent on the trial of this case. And this, as Judge Hamilton pointed out, even the guidelines, I'm sorry, you're doing your job. I'm just railing about the guidelines.
But this case is not about whether Anthony Cook had reason to think he was walking into a place that was doing financial business. This case is about whether that guideline that cabins the meaning of financial institution as it relates to the robbery guideline is cabined by the other reference, is my argument, the other reference to post offices. Those are the two words that we've got to work with. And as I pointed out in my briefs, and I'll state again today, and as this court has said in the commodity futures case that's cited in our briefs, and in my opening brief at pages 17 to 18, the meaning of the term, in that case, financial institution, by the way, it gets more precise meaning from the neighboring words. So our argument all along is that guideline was intended to provide enhancements for robberies of depository institutions where account holder funds are taken. That is the property that is taken.
Where do you get the depository? Where do you get the depository concept?
I beg your pardon.
Where do you get the depository concept as the limiting factor?
It comes from both, number one, looking at the function of the post office and with account holders and box holders where they park their property there, and from the other types of situations that are unlike a depository institution that are found in the other guideline. I see that my time for now is expended. Thank
you. You're not through. You still have a little time left, but you could come back on rebuttal. You can come back on rebuttal for the time left.
Okay, thank you.
Your return to Chicago may be a little calmer than last week.
I hope so. Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Keith Alexander. I represent the United States. Community Financial's core function, its only purpose, is to provide financial services to its customers. I don't think there's any dispute about that. The record was clear that Community Financial offered a wide array of financial services and nothing more. It cashed checks for businesses and individuals. It offered short-term loans. It provided ATM machines for people to access cash. It deposits money on debit cards that are FDIC insured, bill paying services, money transfers. So the only services that it offered was financial services. And so when Anthony Cook robbed Community Financial, he was quite clearly robbing a financial institution.
Now, as one of my colleagues likes to say, I think we have your point, Counselor. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
How much money did they get away with?
$337,100.
That's how much they took. Was there some recovery, or did they catch him, or what happened?
They eventually arrested him. It was sometime after the robbery.
So he got away with all the money then?
Him and his co-actors did, yes.
Yeah.
So
it was a loss of $337,000.
That's correct.
So why do you think, Mr. Alexander, the guidelines have this as an aggravator for robbery?
Well, a number of courts have said that the purpose of this enhancement was to punish more severely those businesses that would be targets of robberies because of the high amount of cash that it tends to hold on to.
Okay. It's a little hard. Let's compare, let's say, an off-track betting parlor or a supermarket that has a few ATMs around or something like that. We see a lot more cash taken from those kinds of operations than from a typical bank robbery.
That is true. I think, for using your example of ATM machines, there are some courts that said that the financial institution enhancement still would apply to them because they're taking the property of the bank. And certainly there are other businesses that are robbed that you identify in which they could take a lot of cash. That doesn't mean that...
They wouldn't have got this much cash. They didn't have somebody inside, would they?
They did have somebody inside here. The teller was one of the co-actors.
I mean, this doesn't depend on government insurance of the deposits, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Okay. So I guess I'm in tracing the evolution, really kind of in the early years of the guidelines, this seems to have wavered back and forth a good deal with banks and financial institutions, or presume the amount of loss is $2,500 early on, at least that much. But it's a little hard to find a unifying rationale behind this enhancement at this point, other than just we want to punish it more severely, which is rather tautological.
Well, I understand your point. I think you're right. The early guidelines, the application notes, said that this was the purpose of this enhancement, was because these businesses tend to have a lot of cash on hand and thus are targets of robberies or hot targets of robberies. And so the guideline writers may have been wanting to deter a little bit more those who would punish or who would choose these businesses to rob, or to punish them a little bit more. I think that's sort of what we're left with. But certainly the text of this enhancement would apply to a business like this, and the district court didn't err in doing it. Just because there are, yes, I think you're right, there are other businesses that have a lot of cash on hand, but they just chose that financial institutions are ones that often do have a lot of cash on hand. And that was certainly the case here, where they took over $300,000 from this institution. And the appellant says that the limiting characteristic is that it's a depository function because the enhancement also applies to post offices. I don't think that works for a number of reasons, but even if we were to assume that somehow informs the definition of a financial institution, the depository function of a post office is much like a money transfer, which is what Community Financial provided. You go to the post office, you deliver your mail, and it's delivered to somebody else. Community Financial takes people's money and can transfer it to somebody else. It's much more like a money transfer than depositing your money into an account that you can later withdraw from. The appellant cites Community Futures versus Worth Bullion, and I think that is instructive here because the test that this court used in that case was what was the core function of the business. The question there was whether a precious metal dealer was a financial institution under the Right to Financial Privacy Act. And while it was true that these precious metal dealers offered financing to its customers, the court found that that was just ancillary to its business. It just was meant to facilitate the sale of gold and silver and other commodities that it sold, that its core function was to sell precious metals. Here, the core function of the business was financial services, offer financial services. That's all it did. This answers, likewise, the constitutional challenge that the appellants raised in their supplemental briefs. This is an as-applied test. The question then is whether a reasonable person under these circumstances would have notice that their conduct would be at risk if they were to rob this business. And for all the reasons that I've said, the name of the business, the services that it offered, certainly a reasonable person would be put on notice that he was about to rob a financial institution. This court does not need to remand that question. The record is complete. The legal briefs are before this court. While it is true that Hurlburt came in after the sentencing, I don't think the court needs to remand for the district court to answer that question in the first instance, given the completeness of the record and the fact that this has been briefed fully here. Finally, just briefly, the other challenge that the appellants raise in their briefs is that there's an impermissible double counting with regard to the physical restraint. In other words, that the same conduct results in more than one enhancement, or that the enhancement is a necessary element of the offense. But that argument was explicitly foreclosed by this court's decision in the United States versus Vizcarra, which held that double counting, so-called double counting, is permissible, unless a specific guideline expressly says otherwise. The appellant has no answer to Vizcarra. There is no impermissible double counting here. The district court appropriately calculated the guidelines, and this court should affirm the court's below-guideline sentence here. And I would, unless the court has any other questions, I would rest on my briefs and ask that the court affirm the district court sentence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'd like to address at least 2 points. Number one, Your Honor, Judge Hamilton raised, well, where does this depository idea come from? I would offer this. If the court looks at the Smith case, which actually is relied upon for part of the arguments provided by the government, the Smith case is cited there. That case will take you to the early history of Guideline 1.3. The early history of that guideline is that it applied, the language was not financial institutions and post offices. It was banks and post offices. That's where the concept of depository institution, I would argue, is kind of infused in this concept of what this guideline was intended originally and continuing on to cover. So I offer that in response to your question, Your Honor. The second point I'd like to make is in reference to the argument that, well, community financial services offered a wide array of financial services. It's kind of an all-purpose financial services center. Well, the difficulty in this particular case, and this could actually be a basis for a very narrow ruling for this court in my client's favor, the particular facts in this case are that in the plea agreement, the only reference factually to the nature of this business is it in document 35 in the record, which is the plea agreement at page 3, in which it characterized the only function of this business as check cashing at that location. The day before sentencing, the government walked in with a website printout indicating that this business, which does business in several states at numerous locations, also has the capability to provide this wide array of other services. But that was never introduced either at the sentencing that this particular location did anything other than check cashing, and it certainly wasn't the basis of the plea. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. And the case is taken under advisement. You were appointed in this. Mr. Thompson, you're appointed in this case?
Walrath.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your service.
Thank you.